Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a really amazing story, a story, you know, of a founder that, you know, he's building something remarkable. They are right now like over 500 employees, raised over 450 million. I mean, really remarkable journey. Talk about, you know, scale and also, you know, like the growth that they have been able to achieve. But again, you know, be prepared today to hear about product market fit, enterprise software, how to think about, you know, a two-sided network and many, many more, you know, interesting stuff. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Rob Gonzalez. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So originally, you know, a kid from Southern Connecticut, but I know that, the story of the family origins, I mean, is quite interesting too. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up?
I mean, life growing up was fantastic. My parents are a mixed marriage. My dad's a Cuban refugee and my mom is a Yankee. And they met at the financial management leadership program at GE Capital. So one thing people don't know about the Cubans is a lot of them ended up outside of New York City. There was a big Cuban ghetto in Port Chester, New York, which is the town just over the border from Connecticut. It's right next to Greenwich, if you've heard of Greenwich. Greenwich is like the richest town in the country, and then Port Chester is absolutely not the richest town in the country, especially back then. And a lot of refugee communities find cheap places to live. So they lived there, and GE was a big company in that area. The world capital of GE was in Fairfield. GE for many years was the biggest company in the world. And so it was a good place to get jobs and build a career. So my dad was in that area, got a job in GE Capital, met my mom, and then started the family.
So I know too that talking about the origins from Cuba, I mean, how your dad got into the country, you know, and the origins too, you know, with your grandfather, I mean, that I'm sure that shaped who you are quite a bit too. So talk to us about this.
Yeah, my dad was a kid when Castro took over, and my grandfather was a police chief in a Havana district under Batista. And so that's not a good look, right? When the communists first take over. And eventually they decide they want to escape the country. And the U.S. government, in conjunction with others in Cuba, figured out a way that they could get tens of thousands of people out of Cuba, kind of under the nose of the way that the Cuban government was keeping track of people that were trying to leave. And the method was effectively that you would get the kids out, and the kids would leave with like nothing, you know, literally just two pairs of socks, one pair of underwear. They would open your bag and search you to make sure that you just weren't bringing anything with you, no valuables of any kind. Although my aunt did sew family gold and jewels and stuff into the hems of her clothing so that she could leave with some kind of money. And they would go to the U.S. And the expected thing that happened next was that they would sit in the U.S. without their parents for a couple months, and the parents would come afterwards. What happened instead is the borders were closed, and the 13,000 odd children, somewhere between 13,000 and 14,000 children, were stranded from their parents. And it's the largest child refugee migration in the Western Hemisphere in history. And a lot of the parents never made it over. There's a couple thousand children never saw the parents again. My grandfather, because of his association with the Batista government, was thrown in jail. All of his friends were shot. People thought he was dead for a year, and then they figured out he was still alive. We had a cousin who got promoted up the ranks of the Communist Party, managed to pull some strings and get him out of jail, and then took him and my grandmother to the airport and held a gun to the head of the Communist Party member that was running the airport and got them on a plane to get him out of the country. So he managed to escape my grandparents. So my dad and his sister actually managed to see their parents again, which was great for me. And so, that experience in the family history does shape you. I mean, you see a lot of immigrant families, in particular refugee families in this country, do really well. You know, they come here with nothing. They just the shirt on their back. My grandfather was in his 50s. And when he died, he had over 400,000 in savings in the bank. And that was just, you know, he didn't even speak the language. That was just him working whatever job he could and saving money and just through grit. And so a lot of immigrant families have that. They open up dry cleaners, they open up Chinese restaurants and stuff like that. You know, my grandfather was a porter. My grandfather did carpentry. My dad made whatever money that he could as a kid, doing paper routes and working at restaurants and washing dishes and whatever. And so there's this sort of, you can actually make things happen that I grew up hearing. Like, this is a country where you can make a life that you want, where you can start over, where you can start with nothing and become rich. I mean, my dad, when he first came over here, he was poor. Him and my sister picked food out of trash cans, and he ended up as the chief risk officer for GE Capital EMEA at the end of his career. You know, it's a senior executive band of GE Capital, which was the biggest financial institution at the time. So, so he made quite a lot of money. So it's like, you know, you can do that in the States. And this whole Horatio Alger rags to riches, hard work pays off story was a big part of what I heard all the time.
The American dream, and you got to embrace it. And, you know, as an immigrant myself, I can totally see it too. So that's unbelievable. Now in your case, you know, obviously you had the family roots and the background that shaped who you are, but then also the fact that your dad, as you were alluding to, you know, he moved quite a bit. And I know that you guys moved to London, and going there for a couple of years and then coming back, it kind of like shifted gears for you when it came, you know, down to readjusting back here in the U.S. So what happened there?
I came back to the U.S. in seventh grade, which is just a terrible time. especially if you're a little bit awkward, it's a terrible time to move. Everyone's going through adolescence. And this is, what was this, 92, 93. I just had a real hard time adjusting socially back in the U.S. And so I wanted something to do with my time because I didn't have the friends that I used to have. That's when I got into computers. I remember in the U.K. they had an Apple system at the school, and I used to play games on it, and I also would do math on it. And I was part of this advanced math program, and I really, really liked math. And I thought, well, geez, if I could get a computer, that would be a good use of my time. That would be fun. So I convinced my dad to get an IBM PC. So that was, you know, my first real exposure to a computer. We had one at home, and I taught myself how to program. I took programming lessons over the summer, and just loved every bit of it. And anything that I can get my hands on about computers, yeah, I'd go to Barnes & Noble and I'd buy the magazines, I'd buy the books, I'd bring them home, I'd play around with them. I just had a blast doing it. I eventually made a lot of friends in the US, but by that point, the kind of bug had caught me with the computers, and I kept at it.
So, I mean, obviously, you kept at it. You went to Williams, you know, to study there computer science and mathematics. But one thing that happened next is interesting. I mean, you went to work for IBM, you know, also Endeca. But one thing that is super interesting as part of your career before you actually got started with Salsify is that transition that happened from being on the engineering side to being more on the business side. So how was that transition for you?
You know, it was an interesting one. And it was at IBM, I was a software engineer and I was in a research group. And I was there for a few years, and IBM was a great place to work, but I was kind of miserable. And at the end of the day, I didn't really understand why, but I think in retrospect, I was miserable because the stuff that we were building was never going to see the light of day, was never going to get used. It was proofs of concept and things like that. And I really desperately wanted to make a difference and have things be used by somebody. And so when I left IBM, I, you know, kind of blamed the programming, the software engineering side for my sort of dissatisfaction, and decided I wanted to get away from it. And I got advice from a guy who was a senior guy at IBM that made a ton of money there, who said, look, the closer you get to sales, the more of an impact, the better off you're going to be. And I thought, okay, well, what's the next step that I can take there? One of my best friends from college, Jeremy Redburn, had already left IBM, and he was working at Endeca. And he introduced me to Jason Purcell, who was taking over the product management organization. And Jason gave me a job as a product manager, even though I literally had never heard of a product management job before. It wasn't something I was exposed to at IBM and in the research group. And Endeca sort of hired people just based on pure intellectual bandwidth. how and that was it. And if you could pass like the IQ test, you could get a job there. And so they hired just absolutely set of brilliant people. And so I passed the IQ test for the product management job. So even though I didn't know what a PM was, they gave me a shot, and that was my first step out of there. And then ever since then, I've just moved closer and closer to the customer. From there, I went into product marketing, and then in the early days at Salsify, I was kind of doing everything, you know, the sales engineering, the sales, marketing, the whole bit.
So double clicking on that, how did you get closer and closer then to becoming a founder? And what was that moment where you guys said, let's go?
I always wanted to be one. I mean, in the 90s, I mean, startups were so awesome. And I was so worried that I was born too late to do anything. And I remember in 99, Jeremy and I were freshmen at Williams, and we would get White Russians and we would drink them in my dorm room, and we would talk about starting a company one day, you know? And so it's something that I always wanted to do. I just wasn't sure how the hell to do it. You know, how do you get money to do it? Starting a company back in the early 2000s was extremely expensive, because you had to buy all the hardware yourself. You know, cloud computing wasn't a thing yet, really. And so I didn't know the path from wanting to start a company of the type that I was interested in, a software tech company, to actually doing it. And so for me, it was something that was always in my mind, and it was mostly a timing issue. And what allowed for it to happen was Endeca had an exit. They were purchased by Oracle for $1.1 billion in 2011. Cloud computing had sort of come along, so it made it a lot cheaper to start companies. Jeremy was freeing up from Endeca. Jason was freeing up from Endeca. I mean, he had to stay on as part of the transition team for a while. And so it sort of came together where all of us were free. We had the time. Jeremy and I wanted to do it for years, and that the setting was right to make a swing at it.
Hey, guys. So pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then let's talk about Salsify. So you guys ended up going at it, you know, with Salsify and making it happen, you know, tremendous journey that you guys say, you know, embarked on, you know, because now, you know, it's say close to 12 years now, which is unbelievable, right? Now, for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of Salsify? How do you guys make money?
We're just an enterprise software as a service company. So we charge a typically annual, increasingly multi-year license fee for usage of the software. The category that we've created is called product experience management. And you can think of the product as a way to manage all your content and data related to products, and then syndicate that product out into the market. So if you sell, for example, most brands are omni-channel brands. Our customers are folks like a L'Oreal or a Coca-Cola. They sell to many different retailers. They also sell direct. So, you know, you might have your own D2C commerce site powered by Shopify or Salesforce Commerce Cloud or Commerce Tools or whatever, but you also have product detail pages on Amazon, on Walmart, on Target, on Kroger that you have to set up and maintain and optimize. And so the system allows you to both manage all your content internally, but also get it to Amazon, get it to Walmart, get it to Target, get it to Kroger, and so on. That so that, and that process exists because e-commerce has become a big thing. I mean, when we founded the company, Amazon was not even a top 10 retailer in the US. E-commerce revenue for most of the branded manufacturers, like if you're Johnson & Johnson, your 2011 e-commerce gross revenue is less than a point, right? It's just, it's not that strategic of a business. Our thought was e-commerce was going to grow and become strategic. And if you're J&J, if you're Coke, you should care about optimizing the conversion rate and the search engine performance on all the big retail sites. Like, just like the same way that there's a Google ecosystem where people are doing search engine marketing and search engine optimization. We thought there should be a search engine marketing, search engine optimization business around Amazon, around Walmart, around Target, around Grainger, right? And all of these websites are different. And the difference between the world of Google search engine optimization and the world of retail search engine optimization is that with Google, you only have to optimize for one algorithm. With retail, you got to optimize for possibly hundreds of them at the same time because all the websites are different. And so if you had a piece of technology that could manage all the content and then play the optimization game on all these retail sites, that would be valuable. So that was the original insight, and that's kind of the context in which the business was founded.
So at what point did you guys say feel like you were turning a corner, and what did that product market fit look like?
The first 2 years were just freaking hard, man. There's no two ways about it. I mean, I was on, my wife was in medical training still, and we didn't have kids. And so I had basically full freedom to just be anywhere I needed to be at any time. So I was on the road constantly talking to anybody who would take a meeting with me to get this thing off the ground. And we got some initial sales. I mean, 3M was one of the first 10 customers we had, for example. They had a digital center of excellence team that was doing experiments, and they brought us on. So we had some initial success, but man, growth was not that strong. We raised a Series A in 2013, largely from folks that were in town that knew Indeca, that considered Jason, my co-founder, who was the CEO of Salsify, considered him in particular to be just an absolutely star investable person. And so we raised an $8 million Series A in 2013, despite not having that much market traction yet. Basically faith in the founding team and faith in maybe the direction of the market. But man, I remember having an all hands maybe 6 months after that, and our chief architect, Joel, we still joke about it to this day. Joel raised his hand and said, man, shouldn't we have more revenue by now? And it was like that. It was just an absolute grind. We were working our butts off, trying to take every meeting we could, talk to everybody we could, and sales were just sluggish. Because at that time, people just, like I said before, people did not care that much about e-commerce. The person that was managing Amazon for a top 100 CPG company was just some junior person in a basement somewhere that rolled into the sales organization, and nobody really paid attention to what they were doing. And they didn't really have budget to spend on software. So what changed for us? And I think if we had founded the company a year earlier, we would have either failed and just shuttered the thing, or we would have had to pivot and try something different. So what changed for us fortuitously was in August, September timeframe, 2014, we're about 2 years into the business, Walmart and Macy's and a couple other major retailers, not coordinating with each other, just on their own, started issuing kind of threats to their suppliers, saying, if you don't start giving us content to power our e-commerce experiences, we're going to start fining you. They call it chargebacks in the business. So if you fail to give us images for the product detail page and a product title and some description that we can use for e-commerce, we're going to punish you somehow. Walmart was threatening to take products off the physical shelf if they didn't have a strong e-commerce presence. Doug McMillon had just taken over there recently, and he had told the Walton family, we don't want to be Sears. You want to not be Sears? We have to take this e-commerce threat seriously. Amazon is going to make us Sears if we don't change. And Doug's been incredible. Well, I mean, what a CEO. But so all of a sudden, you had all these major retailers sending emails to their entire supply base saying, you have to shape up. You have to be a better partner for e-commerce or else. And so the problem that we were solving went from a thing that was yeah, maybe someday I get the value that you're providing, but it's not important to us right now. You know, that type of response to all of a sudden, well, crap, we have to solve this right now for Walmart or we're going to be in trouble. And from that point forward, things got dramatically easier. The market just changed overnight. Like if you look at 2014, we absolutely were not going to make our number that year. Absolutely not. We were at like 25% of our sales target for the year in August. We were screwed. And we hit the number on the year by just in the last 4 months of the year. That's how dramatically it moved. And then we did, like, back in the day, 10 years ago in venture capital, they would look at SaaS companies and there was a rule, you have to triple, triple, double, double, double once you get to your first million. And that's what we did. We did the triple, triple, double, double, double thing right afterwards. We had the first 2 years were a grind. They were stressful. It was just stressful the whole time. It just wasn't clicking. And then the market conditions changed overnight. And then we hit that growth curve and it was awesome.
So how was the capital raising effort? You know, how was that experience too? Because, I mean, you guys have raised $450 million. I mean, that's a lot of money. So how has been, you know, the going through all those cycles too?
So the first cycle, the thing that we did really well the first cycle is because of Endeca, we're in Boston. Like, Boston's a great tech town, but in terms of the you compare it to Silicon Valley in terms of the amount of venture that's invested, it's a lot smaller, right? And you at some point it's possible to know most of the VCs that are in the town. It's just a smaller set of people. So because of Endeca, we could get meetings with all of them, and we met with all of them early, way before we wanted to raise, way before we even started the company, just to tell them about our idea and get feedback and all that type of stuff. We were all first time founders, so we weren't doing the, like, ask for feedback, but really I want to make money. You know, I want to raise money from you someday. We were, like, legit just looking for advice, and we built relationships with them. And so when we got time to raise our Series A, like I said, we didn't have that much traction yet in the market, but we had multiple competing term sheets. And it was based on having built those relationships and having built a conviction within a bunch of venture capitalists that the market that we were going after was a good market. It was going to be a big market. It was going to support an IPO scale business. So the A round worked well. I mean, it was a pretty easy round. The B round, we got it in our heads that we wanted to get some of the West Coast money. We thought it would be useful to expand our network. You know, the Boston network, you kind of, like I said, it's a smaller community. You're always going to be maybe 1-2 degrees of freedom from anyone that you might want to meet. And Silicon Valley just looked like this giant ecosystem, and we didn't have any connection out there. And we thought it would be useful to have somebody on our board that had deeper connections to Silicon Valley. Now, our A round was co-led by Michael Scott and David Scott, and they had invested in Demandware and Acquia and HubSpot. So they were known as really good investors out of the Boston area. And based on their reputations, we could get meetings with pretty much the who's who of the VC firms in Silicon Valley. So I remember going out there with Jason, and we got, like, a media training to do the presentation right. We got this guy who was a producer at CBS for 30 years to you know, coach us up on presenting our story and doing it live in front of the people that you're cold pitching, which is not something that we had ever done. And so we were buttoned up, man. We were psyched. We went out there. We went up and down Sand Hill Road. This is back when they were still on Sand Hill Road. And I mean, it was like a chilly reception. People were really friendly, but nobody really wanted to get in on a B round company. There was one guy who was, I think it's just really funny. He was saying, man, I get the business that you're trying to build, but it just seems hard. You've got this, it seems really grindy. You've got this network component to it. So it's not just that you've got to sell Coca-Cola, but you also have to partner with Walmart. So you've got, it just seems like a hard business. I don't like hard businesses. And also, that red eye flight to Boston sucks. I don't want to get on that flight for board meetings. This is long before Zoom and everything like that. And so we got a lot of receptions like that. And ultimately, the B round was led by Mike Terrell from Venrock, and he's, you know, he's out of Boston, and Mike was a board observer for Endeca, so he knew us, and it was a great round for us, and Venrock is going to do extremely well out of that investment, but the West Coast, we were cold pitching, and it just did not work at all, and then so from that point forward for CDEF, we said, look, we are going to keep a list of the next round of investment. Even if the next round of investment might be 2 years out, we'll get to know them all now, so that when the time comes to take the investment, we're not cold pitching. We're just talking to people who already know us and already know the story and know the value proposition, and are, you know, can almost opt in or out right at the start of the fundraising round. And that served us really well. So C, D, E, F were relatively painless rounds from that perspective, because we had already gotten to know everybody for years. And that's the biggest advice I tell everyone when they ask me about fundraising. It's like, in my experience, the cold pitching did not work. I think it's very hard. I think the more that you get to know the VCs and they get to know you earlier, you build conviction on the team and the market in a way that's just very hard to do in one pitch.
So obviously, you know, like with capital raising, you know, comes a bit on the vision, no? So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Salsify is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, Salsify, there's two aspects to it that are part of the vision. One is, it is the system of record for product within every single major manufacturer. So, if you're a business, you've got an ERP system, right? And that's, you know, contains all your financial data. You should also have a product system. If you're a manufacturer and the product is your lifeblood, you should have a core system that is a, you know, number one, two, or three in your tech stack important system that is your product system of record. And that's what the company would look like. It'd look like the Salesforce for product across the globe. The other aspect is that there's a network component to this, which is, how do you make sure that the great data that a manufacturer is creating that are in their systems shows up in front of the buyer, shows up in front of the shopper at the time of purchase? And that requires, for example, a relationship with a Walmart, a relationship with a Carrefour, Woolworths, or whoever, to be able to transmit data across the supply chain and ultimately have it show up on the website. And I would like that network to be, you know, global and all-encompassing of all the major retailers. And so Salsify becomes, in effect, like the system of record for product and for product exchange and product training for the globe. We're well on our path there, but I mean, I think there's still a significant amount of world and markets and companies yet for us to work with.
Absolutely. So Rob, we're talking here about the future, but I want to talk about the past. If you could go back in time, let's say you go back to 2012, where you guys are thinking about, you know, a world where you guys would start something of your own. And right before, you know, giving the notices and getting going, you know, you have the opportunity of having a chat with your younger selves. Maybe, you know, you took that younger self to, you know, what is it, Quincy Market or one of those places there in
yeah,
Boston. And you're able to have a sit down and give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Oh, man. This is a tough question, because if I had given myself the advice, like the things that I learned along the way, would I have would the company have become what it had become? You know what I mean? Like, I'll tell you, like, a lesson that I've learned is to relax a lot more, be a lot more careful about the usage of my time, be a lot more intentional about what tasks I'm doing versus not doing. And so on and so forth. And so just so much, like a lot more time management and a lot more space for just thought. In the early days, there was zero space, zero time management. It was just 100% activity, pedal against the ground 100% of the time. And it, for like the first whole bunch of years, 5-6 years, it was just all consuming for me in a way that probably wasn't healthy. And, you know, so it's like, I would like to tell myself, don't do that. You know, take a little more time. You don't have to be in as much of a rush. There's a lot that you can't control about this market. You know, it's like I was saying, the first 2 years were just absolute grinds. I was pushing with 100% of my energy and it wasn't moving. And it wasn't until the market opened up that thing started moving. So it's like, not every activity, not every bit of effort is going to yield the results you want. And if you can be clear about what matters and what doesn't matter and create some space, you're just going to be happier throughout the whole journey. That would be the thing that I would tell myself. But I, you know, I don't know that I would have listened to it. You know, as a younger man, I don't think the way I was built, just looking back in time, I don't think I would have listened to that advice at all. Right. I think that if I had tried to calm down and cut things off on my calendar, I just would have found something else to push on instead. And So anyway, that would be the piece of advice, but I don't think it would stick.
Well, that's so profound. So I guess that for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say, hi, Rob, what is the best way for them to do so?
Like, I'm not on the socials really at all. I will check LinkedIn in mails if they've got like a message attached to them. That's probably the best place to find me. But yeah, I'm not on Twitter or X or any of those things. It's not my jam.
Amazing. Well, hey, Rob, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.